And hello, this is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Welcome to Here We Stand. And that was, of course, The Foggy Dew, the song about my ancestors' fight for freedom in Ireland, the Easter Rebellion of 1916, led by a few who were executed for it. But then within 5 years, the Civil War broke out and they finally got independence from England. The example of a few, that's what we're going to talk about today. But we're also going to talk about the inner battle and the fact that we're in a death and rebirth process, personally, as a society. We're not only fighting injustice aimed at us, we're fighting at that thing within ourselves that identifies with the evil. And we realize that we need that personal rebirth to accomplish the outer rebirth. Sun Tzu said that if you don't know your enemy and you don't know yourself, you're going to lose every battle. And so to know yourself and your enemy, you must establish your own terms of battle, and that's what we do all the time. For those listening for the first time, this is the movement to establish the Republic of Kanata, people organized in self-governing assemblies in the face of the corporate global tyranny that's abolished democracy in any form whatsoever. We're meeting more and more of you all the time. You're learning about us at republicofkanata.ca, murderbydecree.com. We're here every Sunday. We're also on a maritime-based Common Law Assembly Zoom call, which you can participate in. It's linking our organizers and people in the assemblies across Kanata. Find out more about that. Write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Well, with me today is my fellow warrior, Deb Golding. Good to have you back, Deb.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here.
You know, I'm reminded listening to that song, you know, it's the example of others over the centuries of leaving us in liberty. They had a sovereignty within themselves that wasn't scared off by intimidation, fear, you know, smears, any of that stuff that seems to throw people off. They had that inner light. And I want to talk about that today. And, you know, you're one who knows this from your own personal life, as do I. The cost that's involved in taking that stand in the face of everything. But I hope we can get into that. And also in the second half of the show, talk a little bit about the practical aspects, the history people might not know about in terms of this fight we're engaged in.
Oh, I sure hope so. I mean, honestly, you and I have spoken a number of times about the importance or the necessity of the spiritual and the physical. And I mean, from my own observations, the gap, I mean, I think we can all look at different scenarios here, but this gap is growing. It's a chasm that is really distinguishing things. It's kind of like, actually, it's doing its job, which is helping us clarify things. And so with that, I would like to check in with you kind of on the state of things. I mean, things are changing so fast, and yet there is this confusion out there. And so I'm wondering, you know, what have been your experiences lately? What's been happening with you?
Well, it's too much to go into, really, but I can tell you in terms of the work I'm engaged in across Kanata and around the world, I mean, there's this real division happening, a sorting out. It's like, you know, the image of separating the wheat from the chaff. A lot of people step back out of fear, but there's even, you know, I often say to people, even when people are attacking you, you can use that to your advantage because, as, you know, I've expressed before, eight of our assemblies in British Columbia have been destroyed by infiltrators coming in and disrupting. And yet out of that destruction has coalesced a few people in each group, former group, that are now reorganizing, and they're much more solid. They see the tactics being used by the adversary. They understand that this is all a maturing process. We learn from every encounter, and they're solid. They're more solid, the five in any group who are left are much more solid than the 30 or 40 who were there before. So that's what we need. This is about finding that remnant, that leadership core who are able to carry on, because those are the ones who continue to fight through every battle and don't give up. And so I find this happening across the country. It's interesting, on the West Coast, of course, it's the most severe. We've had the most attacks in British Columbia and Alberta, and that's related very much to the presence of China, the deliberate takeover of the West Coast, the handing over of West Coast of Canada to the Chinese government by the Trudeau government, and allowing them to station their troops here. And that whole bit, this is a whole different dynamic that you don't find in the rest of Canada. But it's all a sign of hope if we stick to it. And if you go through enough lessons and learn from them and don't give up, you become a real veteran and you can lead many others.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting how, again, I think you're bringing in the same theme of when that separating, that shifting or shaking happens, you know, that the strong are coming forward, you know, that there's lessons learned and there's things that you can refer to. And then we kind of show up for each other, like those who really are holding that strength within them, that vision. It's like we need this great awakening within ourselves. But, you know, before we can have a great awakening, I was thinking about this. I mean, I've been reading a book of yours, a couple of them actually, and in one of them there was a story like, well, I just noticed that you were talking about doing an exorcism on your own people, and then you realized that it was actually a funeral, and that we're, like you said in the intro, we're facing this birth, death, rebirth process. So it's like we're facing a death. I mean, it's in a very real death. So it's like you're going from exorcism to funeral, and funeral obviously means endings, you know, and I'm not sure that we've really even got a comfortability or an ability to hold that mourning and everything. So, I mean, I would love for you to touch in on that and kind of, it seems like it fits here. You know, I would really be interested in what that, your viewpoint of this.
Well, you know, like all of us know that life is a series of deaths, you know. I mean, you know, I often say to people when they're critical of others, saying, well, imagine, remember how you were 20 years ago, you know, your illusions, your assumptions, what you were wedded to. We all change. We have to let things fall away. Sometimes death can be more dramatic, like when you have your whole life wiped out and you lose your family and children and livelihood and everything. And maybe I needed to go through that to get a few kicks in the head to wake up to what my real purpose was. Because I know I wouldn't go back to the way I was before that, even with all of that security and worldly comforts. And yet, what I find, and here's a really practical lesson I learned, that in the assemblies, and even before that, in many of the groups I've worked with, like the Aboriginal survivors of the residential school genocide, when I was a clergyman and we would hold small, you know, Bible study groups or men's groups or whatever, people have an aversion to change because they're wedded very much even to what they think they're opposing. And here's what I find in the assemblies these days. People will speak out against masking, against distancing, against the quarantining, and yet when you then try to take them to the next step of, okay, then let's bring in our own law, as we did on September 8th, and before that in Parksville, British Columbia, we brought in a local bylaw that said these COVID measures are unlawful, they're not warranted, they're unhealthy, so we're standing them down. It's now illegal to impose these things. Then it was up to those 30 or 40 people in the Parksville Assembly who all voted for it, including the ones who later attacked me and said they didn't. They all voted for it, and yet then they had to enforce it. They had to actually go out in the world, and none of them wanted to do it. It wasn't just fear. It's almost like, and I got this impression, we can talk about this, there's this group mind. Sometimes it's called a hegemonicon. In the Bible, when Paul is writing letters to the various churches in Asia Minor, he doesn't write to the congregation. He addresses it to the angel of the church of Ephesus, for example. And the angel is, I think Carl Jung called it the group mind or the oversoul. It's like the big mind that controls all of us unconsciously. It's the unspoken assumptions, just our attachments that don't have any obvious rational expression, but we're wedded to something. Okay, and this thing that we're wedded to turns our minds against it. It sees a challenge to itself, and it's almost like that scene in The Matrix, right? When Neo's walking along, and suddenly this pedestrian in The Matrix starts vibrating and turns into an agent, right? It's like we're all owned by this thing unless we have a conscious break from it. And so the reason I say that is because people who are asked to challenge this thing are too much wedded to it to really challenge it. And they avoid resisting, and they find reasons why they can't act because they're still owned by it. They don't own their own minds. And this is the reality. People engaged in this work don't own themselves yet. They don't have the personal and the spiritual sovereignty. And they come up across that, like Gandhi said, if we will never be politically independent of the British Empire if we don't have soul freedom first. Soul, that sovereignty within ourselves, where we're not part of this group mind. We're part of a different spirit altogether. And that's where social change comes out of. And, you know, there's examples in history we can point to about that. But that's the problem we keep running into. People talk change, but they don't really want to do it because they're still too attached to what they're opposing.
Well, I would say that we're trying to relate to a mechanical system. Like, we're organisms. We're human.
Right.
We're alive. We're organic. And we're not machines, you know, except we have, I mean, we can kind of step back and take a look at the world. And I'm not just going to blame technology, but just the way we schedule ourselves and the way we find this real comfort in being secure and having security. So that gets completely taken over, and it gets messed with and bastardized, you know, in what security looks like. It's a definite way to really make us feel insecure and feel very scared. And so we're running and running and running and grabbing and grabbing and grabbing, looking for the security. And we're told, gosh, you know, even through the structures that are there, like the religious structure, even, you know, it's if you do this, then you get this, then you get this. It's this idea that you follow the list. At least that's what I grew up with. If you follow the list, then you can actually hold God accountable. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So if you're going to be running through this. But what happens really is, because we're not these mechanical systems, we're fighting it, but we're fighting what, like you said, what we're married to. We're fighting what's going on inside of ourselves, and thus why this spiritual side of the of this entire situation is so important, because this conflict and this dissonance is coming, because what we're looking at, we're actually going through a death rebirth process, but we're living through our own death, you know?
That's what I want to talk about, because it's really important. I use an analogy. When you read the writings of the early, I don't want to call them Christians because it was pre-church. It was the early movement around Jesus in the first century. And their writers and their preachers and that, they would talk about their belief that when you're born into this world, you're in a state of possession. You're owned by the prince of this world, what they call Satan. The world and its institutions are all run by Satan. And to come out of that and be a believer in Jesus or the higher power, you had to go through, that's what their baptism ritual was. It was really an exorcism. It was recognizing it was an act of mystery, like this grace, divine grace touching you, and yet you had to accept it and say, I'm stepping out of the old world. And they would go down into these baptismal pools. I don't know if you used to do that in the Mormon church, but they'd have these baptismal tubs, right? And they would literally walk into the water, go under the water, and come up again as if they were being born again out of this new amniotic fluid, right? And they were symbolized their rebirth. They're not owned by the world and by Satan anymore. They're owned by something else, by their own, well, they called it Christ, our higher identity, right? If you don't go through that interchange, you continually, you're like a puppet on a string, right? I mean, you're ruled by the powers of the world. And so to talk about, you know, that death process, we embrace that death because it's a way of cutting off the attachments, the things that control our minds unconsciously in many ways.
Well, yeah, and yet what we're doing, I mean, you've spoken about times when you've been attending a funeral or helping others mourn, and the differences between what you witnessed the natives embracing and what the white man refused to see is kind of what I've seen. Because there's this fear that is generated around the unknown. And I think what is happening, in fact, I know what is happening so clearly, is in all of this unrest, there are parts of us, if not all of us, you know, that there's parts of us that are dying, that are no longer here. And it's kind of weird, too, because if you think about it, you know, here we are, if you want to take the example, at being at a funeral, being at the death, and we're holding on so tightly to what is old, something that has actually expired. Mm-hmm. It had an expiration date. This society, the way things are, It is done. We're witnessing the death, and we're hanging on so tightly that we're stifling the incubation of a new birth. We're ignoring it, and this is the new thing, you know? But here's the funny thing, too, is if you want to put that analogy into allowing the things, you know, like the new to start forming and to have its own growth time, you still don't know what it's going to look like. You can hope. I mean,
okay, and that's the fair part.
It is. Yeah. But we can look at this through childbirth. We can look at this through having a child. Once you don't know, in the old days, you didn't know if it was a boy or a girl even. But you still could anticipate, right?
Okay, well, slow down a bit, Debbie. You catch about four things there that I wanted to address, okay?
Okay, jump in.
Okay, it's good. I know I get it. Enthusiasm is good, but I some of this stuff I don't want to lose in the process, because the reason people can't change is they don't know how to grieve. And
yes.
Change is not about, I'm going to go change society, because we only change according to what's comfortable for us. We modify what is so we can get back to our old comfortable life. But that doesn't bring about change. That's easily co-opted by the system. The only thing that really changes is when we lose everything and we're in a state of grief and despair. And that's why there's such a denial of death and suffering in our culture, because in my life, the only time I really changed is when I was battered and everything was taken from me. Because when you're in a state of despair, then you're open to something else. You don't have your own solutions anymore. You're standing there pregnant. There's this void in you, and it can be filled with something else. And that's why, there's this book in the Bible, Lamentations. And all it is people wailing. You know, when the Jews were driven from Judea and they were carted off as slaves to Babylon, they said, it's over. Our way of life is over. It's dead. And when you accept that something's over, then you can be open to something else. And when that occurs, then change can begin to happen through you. You don't set out and cause change. Change happens through you if you're empty enough. Mm-hmm. This is my experience. If you're open and empty enough, and this is why people say, how did you and 24 homeless Indians cause Canada to admit genocide? Well, because those homeless Indians had nothing in their life, they had nothing to lose, and they were willing to go in and occupy churches and confront these people. Whereas everybody else was holding back, what might happen if I go into a church? I might get arrested. They didn't worry about that because they were battered by cops every day. They had nothing to lose. They had accepted their own grief and death. And so they could be an agent of change. And that's the problem. We don't let ourselves despair and open ourselves to grieve. And unless you grieve first, you can't bring about change. That's the reality, I find.
Oh, no, I'm going to share that reality with you as well. I mean, when I went through my own process of having what I call, my great earthquake, like every foundation I had built my not only my belief system on, but my belief system was so, and my who I was so entwined, that when this all shattered, I mean, everything shattered, everything was gone. It was a full on death. And I know how devastating that is. And then, ironically, what started happening as I was going through this process of seeing how my parents weren't who I thought they were, my religion wasn't what I thought it was, my every way I related to the world started not just shifting but dissolving also. And that was terrifying. And I saw it starting to affect my marriage. And I prayed. I was like, please don't let this affect my kids. I don't want to lose my kids. And that happened too. And it was relationship-wise, but where we've come, and I'm going to speak specifically about me and my kids, we have a very beautiful relationship that is incredibly rich of where it is now. And had those roots been kept where they were, I can tell you 100% wouldn't be the same thing. But I had to do the same thing. It is, and it's terrifying. You know yourself in the box that you're born into. You know yourself by the way people are telling you. And when you lose all of that, when you actually resonate with the fact that inside of you, you know something different, and you are given proof that that's the case from whether it's your own experience or you're just knowing this just comes and explodes upon the scene and you have that shattering, man, that is it's an incredible place to be. And I think you and I can both tell everybody that, from this side, yes, it is definitely worth something embracing, but man, when you're standing in that, it is like devastation, complete devastation all around you, and it is terrifying.
It is terrifying, but there's life in that, because you go through terror and pain. It's like the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It says pain and suffering is your greatest teacher once you lose your fear of it. And when you go through this, and don't back down. And this is what I meant earlier when, the people who survive a smear campaign and a takedown of an assembly, there's a handful of them left, but they have learned a hard lesson, because the best lesson you learn is from a black eye, right?
Yeah,
you don't forget those lessons. And once you have that, you become hardened for the next one. You can endure. And we're looking for those few people who can endure and inspire others, because you only lead by example. And we're going to, well, then we have about 5 minutes before the bottom of the hour, and I want to share something. The what we're going to hear at the break is a beautiful, one of the most beautiful poems ever written in America by Langston Hughes, a Black Harlem writer. And it was Let America Be America Again. And it's America, really a metaphor for any freedom-loving people around the world. And we're going to hear that and kind of segue from that into the next step, which is more issues having to do with the practical, the history people didn't know about and that. But let me just mention that there was an event that happened before the American Revolution. They call it the Great Awakening in the late, 1740s and 50s. And there was this, among a lot of them, it was a rural population, a lot of farmers and settlers. They went through this amazing groundswell, kind of a spiritual awakening. And they were having these mass meetings all over the place, really believing that Christ was about to return. They had to prepare themselves and be good and honorable and virtuous people to receive the new world that was going to be brought in. And that spiritual revival, when you look at the people who then went on to lead the American Revolution, they were leaders in that. They needed that inner awakening, that we're looking at the world in a totally new way from the inside out, being turned inside out and viewing the world in a new way. That's the only way they could achieve their genuine revolution, which was the first time in history people said, we are governing ourselves. We don't need kings. We don't need sovereigns. We are the sovereign. That only came because they had that inner awakening first. And that's a model for us. You can't really just turn it on and off, but you've got to be open to it. You've got to realize, like in meetings, we say, we don't have answers. We might find answers if we're willing to risk and look at our own grief and look at our own complicity. Nothing's being done to us here by anybody. We have done this to ourselves. These authorities that are bringing in all these measures, they are acting out what we ourselves have created. We have, you know, as they say in Hosea, we have sown the wind and now we're reaping the whirlwind. These genocidal measures were done on a lot of other people with our tax money and our compliance. None of the people upset about these measures now were out there with us. When we're confronting genocide, we're talking about the mass graves of children, forced vaccination of Native people still going on to this day. They weren't there, and yet today we're supposed to be there for them. They're not seeing that this is us. We have done this to ourselves. It's not being done to us without our consent and our compliance. So a great awakening means we're cut ties from that. That's why the Republic of Canada came about. We said, morally, we will not be part of this old system of genocide, but we have to accept our own responsibility for it and how we're doing it to ourselves now. And that's, to me, what a great inner awakening is all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned something about there's a parable, the wineskins parable. I actually wanted you to expand on that if you had a moment just to kind of touch on that, because that does talk about the old and the new and how this old system, it can't hold where we want to go. It can't hold the new. Again, it's expired. It has an ending.
Yeah, it's one of the parables, and it's really interesting. I view him in a very human way, Jesus, Yeshua, whatever you want to call him. He had to use stories with people because they just didn't get it, including his inner circle, you know, the so-called awakened ones didn't even know what the hell he was talking about most of the time. So we had to use parables. And one of the parables he used, he was talking about, I think it's in Luke somewhere, he's talking about transformation, how we become fit for the kingdom of heaven. And he said, you can't take new wine and put it into an old wineskin because it'll burst. You can't take a new spirit and put it into an old life. It just doesn't work. And this is what people are trying to do now. They're talking about the idea of a new society, but they're trying to fit it into their old life, and it doesn't work. Everything is expendable. Everything that we hold on to is going to hold us back from that inner transformation. And so a revolution begins inside by our willingness to die, to let go of an old life and to accept a new one. And death is never easy, but it's inevitable. Death is inevitable. It's a matter of whether we accept it or not and change with it, right?
Right, exactly. And changing with it is actually the key there, because as you're talking about grieving and death, you know, we're used to it being an ending, and that, you know, especially with a loved one, the ending is, it's done. They're no longer there. But that's not what we have. We don't have that kind of banality with this. It's we are witnessing right. our own death, but that means we get to witness a new birth. We get to witness the new. It's a gift, really, but it is very much in a place that's unfamiliar at the moment.
It's unfamiliar, and to Frank, tell you the truth, Deb, it may not happen. It might just all be over. This could be a judgment. Mm. Our whole global society could be going down for good, and maybe it's a good thing. We shouldn't hold on to something that's corrupt and criminal and exists through the suffering of many, many people, including many children. We should let it go, and if it means our own death, so be it. But we have to be open to that, and then you're free inside. Once you've accepted the possibility that it's over, then you're free, and you're not wedded to any particular result or anything. So that's a really important, I think, spiritual message. Let's now listen to Langston Hughes, Let America Be America Again. Beautiful poem. We'll come back after for more. Beautiful. The dream. And, you know, it's in a way, Deb, you know, it says that the whole poem there is so beautiful. It said everything. But those closing words, we the people must redeem the land again. We have to take it back. But you can't take it back without the dream, without the vision. And that's, you know, when I was listening to that, it brings tears to my eyes every time. But I think of all my friends who've died and who are still alive or just with nothing, living on the street, struggling. You know, the farmers I know who are like being crushed, sent under, people struggling to keep their heads above water, all holding up for this dream that can be different and feeling inadequate every day. We can't provide it right away. And yet the dream itself is enough. I remember one of my friends, a Guatemalan guy, Antonio, I met him in Vancouver many years ago, and he used to work in Mexico City. He used to go out to the garbage dumps where people lived, and they just lived their whole life in these huge garbage dumps outside Mexico City. And he tried to help them at first. He realized how impossible it was for him to really change much about their life. But he started saying to them, my friends, the only thing I can offer you is a new society, the vision of something different. That's what I can offer you. And I think, Deb, this is how we begin with people. We have to dream the new society for it to come into being. We have to really believe in it with every atom in us. And that's what I get out of this poem. Anyway,
I'm so much in agreement with you that is just the dream, what you would want to see this be, how you can, holding that dream, that thought, that emotion within you, it definitely makes a huge difference. Because that, again, coming back to my own experience, eventually after this death and this experience of what you feel is losing everything, or what really you do lose everything, is finally looking to something better. The something better then comes from within your heart, comes from within your own space, and how that begins to grow is from you. And so I see that, I hear that in those words of that poem. And I know that it's fascinating to me as I kind of reflect on, I'm going to turn it over to you on this one, but it's taking that dream, it's having that, those thoughts, that spiritual aspect, and then creating it in this space of this 3D world, of this physicality, right. This physical world. And you are one of those individuals that seems to be able to bridge the two. I mean, you've got your spirituality vision side, you know, with what it is that, who you are as with a degree in theology, and yet you've also got these other degrees in political science and anthropology, and then you've also got real time, you know, working, you know, with the homeless and working with the indigenous and working to find justice, and yet getting guidance from this spiritual unseen side, the dream side, the real side. That it's this marriage, this bridging between the two that you can speak to. That I would love for you to. I mean, where did that begin? Have you always been that way? Is that something that you had to nurture? Like, how does that work for you?
I was always somebody who couldn't stand by and let somebody else be screwed around. Even as a kid, I remember that on the playground. You know, it's just, I couldn't stand by and let it happen. At a very young age, I finished high school. I didn't even finish high school, believe it or not. I got out there, and I remember I started working in the post office. I got involved in union politics. every campaign, every, you know, movement for justice, I was involved in, heavily involved in politics from a young age. And yet, you know, by the time I reached my 30s, I felt, you know, this isn't enough. I mean, it isn't enough just to be talking about, it's essential to fight for people, and yet they need more than bread, you know. And so, you know, when I made the kind of strange choice to go into the ministry, because everybody in my family thought it was weird when I said I wanted to be a clergyman, but they said, well, you're an atheist. How can you be a minister? I said, well, I'm waiting for the proof, right? I'm like Doubting Thomas, but I'm open, right? But I realized it was a whole part of me and the people around me that I wasn't even addressing, the inner life. And how do you meld the two? How do you bring it together? You can't, you know, in seminary, they had this, in the church, they make these weird distinctions. They called it, there's pastoral ministry and prophetic ministry. So pastoral ministry is when you go and visit people in hospital. Prophetic is when you give, like, you know, sermons on social justice. But I said to them, that's a false dichotomy. You got to do both. You can't heal somebody with a blindfold on about what kind of society you're in. You got to bring the two together. And that's all I've been doing for 50 years. I mean, like, trying to witness to that. But when you do that, and I want to lead into that as a segue into this, when you do that, you're taking on enormous forces. Like, you take all the wealth in Canada and you divide it up among people, and everyone would get $250,000. But all of that wealth is being pumped out of the country. And if you challenge the forces that are doing that, look what happened in Parksville on Vancouver Island. We issued a summons against two of the guys who had been named in the common law court trial against the Vatican and the Crown of England. These two local United Church ministers, Phil Spencer, Foster Freed, directly involved in what's called the 12 Mile Club, which is the trafficking net on Vancouver Island of Native children, the ritual torture and killing. This is all documented, murderbydecree.com, it's all in there. Our common law assembly in Parksville had just issued an arrest warrant against those two, 2 days before the assembly was taken down. And that's no accident, because these guys have powerful connections. And the last thing the Chinese and the offshore human trafficking network people want is for assemblies on Vancouver Island be forming and issuing arrest warrants against these powerful individuals. So you can have faith, but when you try to put it into practice in the world, look what happens. You get an enormous, you know, the smears, the attacks of every kind follow from your principles. And there's a whole history on that people need to know about why these attacks on these assemblies are happening and why, you know, I was talking to some of the organizers in Alberta today, and they said, everywhere you go now, there is the same story being put out, don't trust Kevin Annett. And when you look into what they're saying, it's the recycled smears the Royal Canadian Mounted Police put out 20 years ago when I held our first tribunal into residential schools in the summer of 1998. Exactly the same images and words. They're just rehashing it. These groups are, you know, front groups by the government to cause divide and conquer methods among the one movement that's really threatening them, which is our common law public assembly movement, because we're saying people have to take back power. They can pass their own laws. They can become a new society right there in their new assembly. Nobody else is saying that, so we're primarily targeted for that reason. Now, I know that was a long answer, but to me, it's all connected because, you know, the inner and the outer merge, but then you're a threat. You're no longer a victim. You then become a threat. And their main, the way they deal with threats is to isolate and destroy and to get everyone so afraid of you that they don't want to work with you. And that's what they're trying to achieve right now.
Well, I think isolation is definitely the key word again. I think we've brought that up before in other broadcasts that we've done together. I bring it up often because that I know is such the mechanism that is used in the ritual torture that I experienced for the years that I did. I mean, the whole idea is to really instill isolation and then drive that wedge further and further. I mean, just so you end up becoming confused and shattered as an individual, and they're doing that at a society. It's happening like on a global scale. You know, this isolation is really happening, and yet you've got some very specific things that you have been experiencing that I don't know if everybody can follow it. Like, there are these events that are happening, right? And you can look at them and go, oh, well, let me tell you, I'll connect the dots from here to here to here. But if the events aren't seen that way, they can look like isolated and individual events. Yep. So if you could track that for some people, just kind of say, hey, look, let me draw some lines here so that you can see how this works, that would be super helpful.
Well, yeah, here's a specific example we can use. Going back, we don't have to go back 25 years, although, frankly, you've got to know the history of this. And that's why I urge people to go to murderbydecree.com and just do more self-education about this stuff. But here's one example I can give. In June 4th, 2019, Justin Trudeau publicly admits a genocide occurred in Canada. He said that publicly. Yes, it was genocide. Okay. At that point, there should have been a war crimes tribunal convened under international law, according to the UN Convention on Genocide, because it said any country that admits to or is proven to have committed genocide must be, quote, prosecuted and punished. Okay. So we immediately, the tribunal, the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, it issued a summons to him and Julie Payette, the Governor General of Canada, saying, we are charging you with complicity in genocide. We are convening a war crimes tribunal in September 2019 in Vancouver. You are hereby summoned to appear. We, in the ICCCS and our network here in Canada, we informed everybody. We informed all the UN agencies, the international common law courts, and conveniently, of course, it was ignored by the corporate media and everything, as usual, but we, coming out of that, I began my own personal action in British Columbia in February. Following up on that, I issued notices of liability to Trudeau and 12 other people who were directly complicit in these crimes, the ongoing crime of genocide that led to these COVID measures. Now, two of those people were Fried and Spencer, the ministers on Vancouver Island, the United Church clergymen I mentioned. But the notice of liability saying, I'm going to hold you responsible personally for the damage you did to me, my children, my family, all of these other people who died as a result of this crime, they didn't respond, so that's an admission of guilt. I then issued them a default notice, which said, I can now apply to put a lien on your property and have you arrested. Just before I was applying for that in the courts, COVID measures came down, conveniently. All the courts closed. So that whole action is hanging there in midair, and yet it is not unrelated to anything that happened subsequently, because the last thing these criminals want is for the truth of the crime to come out, because then people know, okay, if they did to the Indians, okay, here's how they're going to do it to us. And the forced quarantine measure, the vaccinations, the medical experimentation happening just a few miles down the road in Nanaimo, the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, you know, all of that stuff proven to happen. If people learn about that stuff, they can have a defense now against what's happening with the COVID measures, but they can't have people know that. And so they immediately wipe the memory of all of that out. They bury all that. And yet we can still act on that. And that's really one of the reasons the common law assemblies came about. How we enforce it, and people always say, well, how do we enforce these measures to stop COVID? You enforce it by taking the power and the law into your own hands. Right? Mm-hmm. You create something new. You create a new assembly, a new court, the power to go in and make those arrests. And we issued, and like I mentioned, there were arrest warrants for the Spencer and Fried issued by the Parksville Assembly. The sheriff was about to go deliver them, and then the assembly explodes from within. And I want to read that to you. This is actually really relevant. I got this anonymous email after the fact. October 19th, to whom this may concern. I swear that I was present at a meeting on August 29th in Parksville where members of the Oceanside Common Law Assembly, or OCLA, that was the Parksville Common Law Assembly we set up, where I was present at a meeting where members of OCLA were offered guarantees of immunity from prosecution for defying COVID if they broke ties with Kevin Annett and publicly denounced him. This offer was made by an unidentified plainclothes individual who said that whoever agreed to this deal would receive police protection. Those present from Auckland included Harry Ogden, Sean Buchhold, and John McCart. All three of them and several others accepted the offer. I excused myself from the meeting. Later after the fact, the same people, after they had thrown out Kevin from Auckland and lied about him, I was warned by phone by Mr. Ogden that I would pay a stiff price if I told anyone about the deal. He said I'd be messing with people bigger than the government and said, quote, you can't do anything for Annett. We're wiping him out in every assembly on the island, unquote. I relocated from Parksville for my own safety. I pray for everyone's safety and especially for Kevin. name withheld. I happen to know who that person is. And we have two other people who've signed affidavits saying, yeah, the Mounties came to the Parksville Assembly members and offered them a deal that they, if there's any prosecution happening for people not obeying COVID measures, they will be exempted. They won't be touched. And I mentioned to you earlier, Deb, that it's like in the residential school. The little Indian kids were told, if you rat out your fellow students, if you report the children who are talking their own language, you'll get better food. You won't get raped as often. You'll be in what's called a protected group. Every Indian residential school had that. It's the same mechanism of divide and conquer today. They say to people, okay, we won't go after you. Just turn on Kevin. Denounce the Republic. This has happened so many times. I've seen this break apart our groups for years because they appeal to people's fear by making a deal. They perfected this technique going back centuries, and they're using it again. So I'm mentioning all of that to show that we know their tricks. We know a way around it. But unfortunately, most of the people in our movement don't have this experience. They don't have this understanding. So they fall prey to all the lies. But the knowledge of this history is power. It gives us a way to overcome their methods.
Well, I'm hoping that the sharing of this is actually encouraging to people and not discouraging. It is part of what this is all about. There's, you know, as you want to create something new, and the old system does not want to die, and it does feed off of you, that, you know, there's going to be repercussions for this. And yet having this experience and having, you know, just being able to share with people, it's like, look, this is something you can anticipate. And if it never happens, then bonus. But if it does, it doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It doesn't mean that you are failing. It doesn't mean that, you know, you should be giving up. It's definitely something that is just kind of, I don't want to say growing pains, but, you know, growing pains. And in a way, I believe I read in another one of your books, you had a forewarning once before, too. You had somebody, Mark Angus, would actually pulled you aside and told you, kind of gave you the heads up before you had to have the experience. And now you're on both sides of this, and maybe you could share a little bit about what Mark told you.
We've only got 5 minutes here, but I do want to share Mark's quote. It happened just before I got fired from my church in Port Alberni. And Mark was a homeless guy. He used to come to church, and he would share with me his personal visions he had, and he was quite an amazing young man. But here's a quote from the book when he's talking. He says, I've got to tell you all this, Kev, because I don't have much time left. And in fact, Mark subsequently was found dead in a hotel room. I believe he was killed. He said, I know too much of their shit, and they know it. I've been stupid, mouthing off to the wrong people, but I'm not worried about me. It's you I'm afraid for. You're the one it hates. You're the one it wants to destroy. What do you mean by it, Mark? I interjected. He gave a slight shudder and shook his head. You don't know what you're up against, Kev. The evil thing that's killed all those children, it's hiding behind religion. It's hiding in our own church. It hates that you're pulling off its mask and exposing it, and it wants you dead. You don't see it. You're too good and trusting with people, even the ones who are trying to wipe you out. But you can't trust anyone now, not even your own wife. You're going to be totally alone. You'll only have God on your side. And, you know, his words, and I repeated them at his funeral when I conducted his funeral the next month, you know, his words have been so borne out that this thing we are exposing, it isn't just the churches, it's a malevolence. It's going back to our original point about the hegemonic on this unseen power that controls everybody's minds, that's the real enemy. It does not want itself exposed. And unfortunately, or fortunately, actually, I've done that. And so it's what's really behind the smears, the division, the people falling back. People know intuitively that there's something much bigger and more evil at work here than just a bunch of people wanting to make mega bucks off pushing vaccinations on us. That's a symptom of something. We're in a spiritual warfare to the death. And those of us who see it and who lead it are protected. I'm still alive because I have that protection around me because I'm being put here to do this, to end this thing. And I know that now. I know that's my purpose. And people will see that if they know some of my history. And the only reason I go on about my history is because it's a lesson for all of us. Because if you don't learn from our own lessons among each other, we're just going to fall prey to this thing. So I thank you for mentioning Mark. I honor him and his memory.
That was pretty powerful. I don't know what to say other than that was That was pretty amazing. This has been a very, very powerful show. I hope people listen to what this is and be very kind to themselves as they go through their own transformations. Like, transformation is it's a full on event that takes some time, and it's full of some joys and full of some sorrows, because there's a lot of little deaths that happen through that evolutionary experience of becoming the self that, you know, we're here. You know what your mission is, and you're living it. And that was hard won in a lot of ways. And we all get that privilege. We all get to have that privilege to be able to be in that space. And so I would just encourage everybody that feels like they're going through a transformation or stepping into one to do it with courage and kindness for themselves.
Thanks, Deb. It's always good to have you on, and your own wealth of wisdom from your own life experience, it's always appreciated when you get it. So I thank you for being with us today. And we'll have
Thanks
you
for
back.
Having me.
For people, we've only got a couple of minutes left, so I want to remind folks, republicofcanada.ca, murderbydecree.com, you can see a lot of my books there, and write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com. We're going to carry this on again, I hope. We're going to have more, as we've had in previous shows, more of the local organizers on the ground talking about their experiences. But leaving you with this one thought, that it's a big step. It's not for everyone. You've got to know yourself and know your enemy. That's how we began the show. Know that your enemy, you're part of it. You're part of that enemy. You're part of the thing we're fighting. We have to find that inner break. And it usually happens through our own grief and suffering of a loss. One of our organizers told me the other day, her own daughter won't speak to her anymore because her own daughter's wearing this muzzle. Our own families are coming apart because of the civil war going on within and without. And yet we seize that opportunity and realize, and I said to her, you have another family. You have a higher family and higher purpose. And it's only through your pain and loss that you're going to come to that fact. And we'll stand there with you, but it's something you've got to do your own. As they say, you got to walk that lonely highway. Nobody can do it for you. You got to do it by yourself. But the prize at the end of that highway is real liberty, inner and outer. And that's what we're committed to in the show. Thank you, brothers and sisters. And we'll be back, as always, here. Final song. It's called The Minstrel Boy. It's actually one of my favorite songs. It's from Ireland, just like the first one was. And it's that song of the minstrel boy who would rather die and destroy his harp rather than let it be used by the forces of slavery. I guess that's the choice we all have. And I should mention that what book I was quoting out of is called Unbroken, My Life as a Truth Teller. It's my most recent book you can get on Amazon. But don't worry that it's on Amazon, folks. Yeah, it's a corporation, but it's coming down. This whole sick system is coming down. Now the question is not bringing it down because it's bringing itself down. The question is, what are we going to do to replace it with inside and outside? That's our purpose, our mission. I thank you, brothers and sisters. Stay strong. Stay clear. We'll win.